Welcome to the I-29 Mu-U Dairy Podcast. The I-29 Mu University is a consortium of the land-grant universities located in Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska. This podcast covers timely news, information, and research for today's dairy industry. Hi, my name is Jim Sulfer with the University of Minnesota. I'm a regional dairy educator, and I'm joined by co-hosts and colleague today, Fred Hall from Iowa State University. He's a dairy field specialist. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you. It's always fun when we have these new topics to talk about. I'm excited for today's program.
Yeah, I am today. And on today's podcast, we're excited to be joined by actually sort of two of my colleagues, both from the University of Minnesota. One is Dr. Tim Goldsmith. He's a veterinarian and professor in the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine, and a really relatively new employee, maybe a month or so, that Dr. Angie Barnum. She's a University of Minnesota Extension Livestock Veterinarian. Welcome to both of you, and why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourselves?
Afternoon, everybody. First time on this podcast. Thanks for the invite, Jim. Big picture, I'm a Minnesota farm kid, veterinarian trained here at the University of Minnesota, graduated 2001. I was in private practice for several years before coming back to the college, currently with the veterinary population medicine department in the ruminant division, primarily involved in third and fourth year clinical teaching of our veterinary curriculum. I'm focusing on primarily beef cattle, but cattle in general within that role.
Okay, Angie, how about you?
Yeah, hi, Jim. Hi, Fred. Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me on the podcast today. I am a new employee with the University of Minnesota Extension Service. My position is Extension Livestock Veterinarian, which means I work with beef, dairy, small ruminants, and some other types of livestock in educational programs, bringing information from the university out. I am a veterinarian by trade, and I worked previous to this role in central Minnesota with livestock. So traveling to different operations around here, consulting with producers for about 6 years. Before that, I graduated from veterinary school at Colorado State University, but I am a Minnesota native. My previous life was as a Spanish teacher. And I mention that because that language ability has enabled me to see some different diseases that we will discuss today that exist in Central America predominantly.
Okay, good. Well, thanks, Angie and Tim. New World Screwroom's really been in the news a lot the last several months. And so actually, a couple of weeks ago, it was in the news that there was a first case identified in a person in the U.S. during this year. My understanding, particularly, Tim, you had mentioned earlier in a conversation that it's not like we've never had cases of inhumans in the U.S. It's not like it's been extremely unusual. But can either of you or tell us a little bit about kind of the history of the New World Screwworm in the U.S.? And because I think it has been in the U.S. In the past, but it's been several decades ago.
Yeah, I'll start out and Dr. Arnhem can jump in. Back to your human case. So that case was actually in early August. And that is the first case in the U.S. tied to the current Central America outbreak. That's what makes that one unique. There has been other human cases not tied to the current situation in past years. It's not that we never see it. It's infrequent by far. I mean, we're in the single digits, I believe, when you think of those. But it's been handled and taken care of. But back to kind of the big history of when we have seen this in the U.S., since I'm of the generation that's never seen this, I was born in the 70s. This was in the 50s and 60s is when this was a major issue in the southern states in the United States. If you look at the official maps, it'll show you that the like 62 to 66, it was eradicated in the southwest part of the United States. I think officially they say it was eradicated from Texas, and the last case was seen in 1983. This pest, it's a pest is what it is, was kind of pushed down through Mexico and Central America down to through Panama to the Darien Gap, which is kind of the narrowest part of Panama in the early 2000s. And so it's been kind of pushed south using different techniques of trapping and primarily the sterile insect technique, where they release sterile flies. Because a unique part of the screwworm fly's life cycle is that the female only mates once. So by releasing millions upon millions of sterile male flies, when that female mates with a sterile male fly, then she can't lay eggs. And that, along with treatment of cases and other techniques, was used to push this pest south through the Darien Gap, which where it was and where they maintained it using sterile flies up to about 2 years ago is when this issue started to have an issue in South America, and you started to see the fly move northward again for various reasons that maybe not fully understood, whether that's inappropriate livestock movement, issues with producing enough flies or delivering enough flies, and maintaining that have all been proposed. I personally haven't heard any one simple answer to these things, but that's allowed it to start to move north, currently moving north. And some of that northern detection within Mexico is what's prompted the USDA to close the border and take other actions that we've heard of.
Have they been able to kind of stop it moving north, or are they still finding outbreaks further north than they were, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago?
Chime in if you know more, Dr. Barnum. But to my knowledge, I've only heard the latest report that I'm able to access through USDA information. I haven't heard a more recent summary of any more northern findings than the latest one that was reported that caused them to reclose the borders in July. So to my knowledge, that they haven't found it any farther north. But by all the reports and summaries we hear from USDA, they're working with the Mexican officials to try to better understand exactly where it is and other things going on within Mexico. So we could have something come out in the future that would do that. But to my knowledge, that's the latest. 370 miles south of the US border was the latest one that we've seen information on.
Because of the biology of that fly, what is the northernmost climate that you would expect they could prosper in?
We don't think that the adult flies are active under about 65 degrees, but that temperature doesn't really kill them. Our friends at Texas A&M Cooperative Extension, who are likely very much on the alert, published some temperature-dependent risk guidelines, and they're listing low risk as below 59 degrees when that life cycle really, the life cycle of the fly, which is the New World screwworm larva, really slows down or becomes almost inactive. And so we in this northern climate are very fortunate to have our rough, harsh winters when it comes to this parasite.
But they would be active June, July, August,
Correct.
if they rode a truck north to the feedlot here in Sioux County, we could see a couple of generations of them.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity to talk a little bit about the life cycle of the fly because it's going to depend on any parasite you're talking about. How they behave tells us how we can behave or how we should behave. And so the fly's life cycle really lasts only about 21 days, we think. And so a new infection in Minnesota would look like, yes, an infected animal, but it would be hard for that fly to reproduce throughout the entire year, as it will be possible in some other climates. Ultimately, when the fly sees or is attracted to an open wound, she deposits the eggs on the side of the wound, and sometimes you might see them in certain cases. The eggs will develop in the wound, and then they become that larva, that very typical screwworm picture that we're all seeing in the news of like a maggot-looking thing. That larva matures in the wound, but currently what we know is that in order for that live larva to become another fly, which goes on to infect more animals, it needs to actually fall off the animal and pupate in the ground. And it burrows superficially into the soil before it emerges and becomes another fly. And so that's where our temperature, we're at least hopeful, is a positive in the northern climates of the US.
You know, one thing we didn't cover that maybe we should, for people that maybe haven't been keeping up with the news, why are we so concerned? I mean, if I'm just a listener, I go, you guys are talking about a fly and maggots. We have those all over the place in Minnesota. What's so unique about this particular organism or this particular fly or larvae? Just a short, brief introduction of why we're so concerned about this versus my house flies.
This fly, this larva, more specifically, the fly isn't so much the problem as is the larva. And this larva feeds on live tissue versus any other larva, maggots that we're more familiar with will just eat dead tissue. So, as a veterinarian, our job is to clean up that wound and the maggots typically go away. In this case, wound cleaner is not going to help because the larvae are not going after dead flesh. Most of the infections start with a wound that, like I mentioned, the flies are attracted to. But what we're learning about this fly is that they're attracted to all types of wounds, some of them being extremely small and almost unnoticeable. I've heard at least that they'll start an infection in a tick bite, for example, that small of a wound. And then the larva will continue eating the normal, otherwise healthy tissue of the animal, which you can imagine how it severely compromises livestock, wildlife, potentially pets, and it can infect humans as well. Something I wanted to point out about the human case, which we were just discussing, is that this is not a zoonotic infection, meaning this isn't something that the livestock are going to pass to us. However, humans are just as susceptible to these flies as livestock or any other animal species are. So that's something we share in common. Now, luckily, this recent human case in the US was travel associated, so not given by a fly biting this human. In the US, it was from a fly biting, or excuse me, from a fly laying eggs in another country, and then this human traveled to the US.
So, Tim, I know you've been on a number of webinars and trying to really kind of stay current with this. Kind of where are we and what is the US doing about it as we're moving forward? And then I think there's been some discussion that you had mentioned about maybe some potential concerns in wildlife or getting in a, you know, I think Angie covered pretty well. If I have an infection in my dog, I can look at my dog every day and maybe potentially see these larvae, but what is the risk of getting it, maybe more in the southern US, in the wildlife population? Is that a concern, or is that maybe just, maybe it's not a concern?
Yeah, great question. Dr. Varnum did a great job of highlighting the point that this isn't zoonotic. This isn't livestock to people, people to livestock. It's this fly will lay its egg on any warm-blooded species, right? So it doesn't care that you're a cow or a dog or a deer or a human. So the most recent cases we had in the US in 2016 were actually in the Florida Keys, and it affected the roe deer population there, which is a small deer that is found in the Keys of Florida. So that's a great example of it was identified, I think, in a few pet species, some raccoon, and then the deer population was the big one. So if we think about that and go back to wildlife and like I said, one of the actions that USDA has taken is close the border for livestock and equine imports from Mexico into the United States. They have a very robust inspection process when live animals come across the border in legal fashions where they're approved imports. There's people there to inspect those animals and look for this. And they've kind of stopped that to do that. But as you can imagine, there's nobody inspecting wildlife or things like that that can go wherever they please. if we think about the potential of this wildlife movement, along with pet movement, what can do that pet that you travel with could easily be infected as that person, right? That came to do those things. And then if we think about the wildlife industry, I'll just take Texas, for example, if any of the listening is not familiar, the captive wildlife hunting industry in Texas is massive. So the amount of captive deer and other, including African species that they have down there, are all susceptible. So one of the interventions we have, if we do get it, if you think about livestock, and we talk about inspecting our livestock and inspecting our pets for a wound that's not healing, for something that's out of place. With our domestic species, we can do that through different management procedures we have. But if we start moving into wildlife, that's a different game, right? So the ability to inspect wildlife, whether that's deer or feral pigs or whatever that is, it changes the game, right? And that can be a place where this can start to grow and get out of control, just because of the different, I'm not gonna call lack of inspection, but the difference in the ability to inspect those species, right? You can have something going on for quite a period of time before it can be noticed, and probably would be noticed as dead animals, quite frankly, in some of those wildlife species before we know what's there. So there's other ways that USDA, back to your first part of that question, what's USDA doing? And I'll say USDA and some of the southern border states, they're implementing more inspection to do that. Texas and some of the southern states are starting to put out some traps. When I say traps, I mean fly traps. So it's kind of a passive way to monitor the situation. They've kind of resurrected a tool from back in the day of the eradication activities, called, I call it slow worm, but it's S worm. But it's kind of a fly attractant that's supposed to replicate a wound smell to draw in the female flies, right? Some of those passive things are happening. USA just announced a couple of weeks ago intentions to fund and build a new sterile fly facility in Texas. Currently, the USDA funds and controls sterile fly production, but that is down in Panama, in cooperation with Panama. So we have no domestic production. They have just approved that, and that facility is supposed to be built on Moore Air Force Base, which, if you read the history, used to have a sterile fly production facility back in the 50s and 60s. They're gonna build a new one there that's capable of producing up 300 million sterile flies per week. So that's happening. They're also funding Mexico to refurbish. They use similar technology for fruit flies. They're gonna switch over a fruit fly facility to produce screwworm flies to do that. And just things like that that are happening from the inspection, observation, things like this, just awareness of, if we think about just our livestock producers and our veterinarians, there's a generation that hasn't seen this pest. Dr. Varnum's a unique one that's actually seen it because of time spent in Central America, right? If you're a Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin veterinarian like me, we've never seen this, right? And so just awareness that what's it look like? It's not just maggots on a necrotic wound, right? This is a fresh wound and a growing wound and things like that, so that we identify it as soon as possible. Treatment of that wound, cleaning that wound out, removing the larvae before they come mature flies is part of that process to keep the fly numbers down, right? So huge awareness activities so that people are aware are all, in addition to everything else I said, are all things that are happening.
So, Angie, since you are the only person on this podcast that has actually worked, or not worked with, but been around areas with this, where this has been endemic, so it's there all the time. What do people, I mean, it sounds like a nasty thing you don't want around. How do those countries deal with that? I don't think that'll become an issue up here, but it could be in the summer. What do they do?
Yeah, it's an extremely frustrating disease or parasite to deal with once it enters your country, as you live in Central America, let's say. The experiences that I've had are thanks to the organization and partners of the organization called the Equitarian Initiative, which provides veterinary services to livestock in Central America and parts of South America. Pulling from the experiences of some of the veterinarians in that network, what I've learned is that being able to know where the parasite is heading is step number one. So things that I've learned about how we can handle that here would be, enabling livestock owners to report it as easily as possible, and ideally including a veterinarian or not, but allowing the identification of those larvae is step number one. The larvae themselves can look like other types of maggots, and certainly we see it in mixed infections, meaning the screw worm is there, but so are other types of fly larvae. I've seen cases where the animal also has just incredible numbers of ticks, and this animal is just a museum of parasitology. And so knowing where the parasite is going by tracking it has been helpful, especially if you can enable that to be done quickly. There is a large amount of concern because these are animals that are the livelihood of individuals, and so their lives are at risk. Some of the most helpful things maybe I can share about seeing a few cases like this and things I've learned from my colleagues in Central America is that the treatment of this parasite sometimes requires a little bit of creativity. One case that I recently saw was actually a puncture wound, and the puncture wound had grown to where I could visualize the wound. I could see it and I noticed it, but I didn't see the larva, as in some of the photos we see from our counterparts at the USDA. I actually was instructed to spray something inside of that wound in order to the larva will then leave and then you can see them. So just because you don't visually see the larva doesn't mean they're not there in a lot of cases. And that reminds me too, one of the most common sites of infection, according to COPEG is the
Panama, United States Commission for the Eradication and Prevention of Screwworm Infestation in Livestock.
Oh, okay.
Initials would be Spanish, but abbreviated COPEG,
Okay.
COPEG. The top condition leading to miasis or screwworm infection was at the umbilicus. And so we're kind of trained to think wounds, but I think a lot of the veterinary professionals in Central America are starting, and in Mexico, are looking outside of just typical wound sites, including in a recently calved cow, a cow who has recently calved, I should say, inspecting the vaginal vault of that animal because the screw worm is able to lay eggs along simply mucosal surfaces, areas where the skin and mucous membranes meet.
So how
So
far does this fly move? I mean, if say we, for some odd reason, we get an infection somewhere in a premise somewhere, is that a typical fly where they don't go maybe more than a mile or yards? Has anybody looked at how far, just on their own, not being carried by a fomite, just on their own, how far do they fly, or how far will they fly to look for a host or a site? Does anybody know that?
I don't know if you've seen it, Dr. Varnum, on an actual number, but if you look on some of the historical stuff, which I spent some time doing, they'll claim that it wasn't able to move across the Mississippi River on its own in the southern US. So they
Okay.
kind of look at east of the Mississippi separately than west of the Mississippi. And if you look at some of the eradication maps, they'll show that east of the Mississippi, they eradicated it in 59, where west of the Mississippi, they didn't eradicated until 66. I'm sure it can fly as far as the width of the Mississippi River, but probably less frequently. And it's going to be kind of like other flies, how I think of it. And correct me if you disagree, Angie. It's going to be local movement, but the long movement's going to happen with movement of animals. Movement of infected animals is going to move them, hundreds of miles. Locally, it's going to move maybe a couple miles. And that may depend on the density. If it finds a host closer, it's not going to go very far
Yeah.
to do that, right? As in most flies.
So when I was in Texas, there were still remnants of the old dip vats on some of the big ranches. So think forward with me. Next June, I've got a pot load of feeders just come off grass, and they're coming to my feed yard. Is there a preventative therapy or treatment I need to be thinking about when they're hit my load and shoot?
Well, the best recommendation, Fred, we consider you a friend now, so we'd love to talk about your particular hurt, but the best recommendation would be to consult your veterinarian. However, I can say that the FDA is just recently put out some guidance for us veterinarians on just that topic. And as you're aware, when we treat food animals, we have to treat them using things that are on label. And you're asking about dips and external topical antiparasitics. We are working with the FDA is working, I should say, on extra label drug use for screwworms. I did a little bit of digging because I was in Central America and kind of questioning what do I grab, what do I choose. And the way I've tried to think about it, Fred, is this way, that we're both trying to lessen the fly burden as well as get the larva out of our animals. And so you'll see recommendations for both larvicides and insecticides. So the insecticides working on the fly, the parasiticides or the larvicides working on the larva in the animal. I guess I'll put it this way. As far as larval control, so once an animal has the larva, we don't have any reason to believe that products like ivermectin or doramectin wouldn't be effective against this larva, if you catch my gist. And then, as far as fly control goes, your standard insecticides you think of, we believe those are effective against the New World screwworm fly. So, things like permethrins, for example, as well. Nothing too fancy there. It's more a matter of making sure that what we're choosing to treat our cattle with, treat being preventative in some cases as well, is on label technically. And the FDA is working hard on that to make sure that those recommendations are in place.
Because if you think about what we do when we pull these cattle off wheat and run them north, they've been castrated. If they had horns, we've knocked them off. So we've created some issues that could potentially be problematic.
And to that point, Fred, if you look at some of the recommendations from those Central American states, they'll actually have preventative things recommended to be done to those calves prior to those procedures to help protect them. So there are things we can do if it does become an issue to help lessen that.
It sounds like you're aware and putting things together. Will we have a white sheet that we can put on our websites for our producers?
I'm happy to put something together for this podcast, referencing some of the resources we mentioned in this discussion. But I'm aware that there are some resources that were put out by a group of extension veterinarians who are trying not to reinvent the wheel as far as sharing resources. Fred, I'm happy to pass those links that were created as well,
Thanks.
including some really great fact sheets.
I think that would be a real benefit for this podcast when we get it up on the website that we have those companion pieces. We've covered some really good information. What should be the takeaway that our producers should definitely walk away from this program with?
I think the big one is to remember this is not in the United States. The sky is not falling or hasn't fell, but it's one of those things that we need to remember our history. We need to remember the effort that was undertaken by our predecessors to get this pest out of the equation so we can enjoy the luxury of not having to deal with it on a daily basis. Let's not relive all those lessons. Learn from what history has taught us on how to manage it and do things. And then just remember the first step is awareness. You got to be aware in order to identify anything.
Well, I've thought about this a lot because the screwworm has quite the name, doesn't it? It gets all of our attention. And that's not to belittle the effects it's having right now on the world. But I agree with you, Tim, that it's a disease that's easy to sensationalize in some ways. And much of what we talked about today goes back to management and husbandry and knowing your livestock, right? We can't always fix everything going on with wildlife as producers, or we can't fix it at all in a lot of ways. But we knowing your livestock and examining them, scenario you provided earlier, Fred, about bringing calves off of pasture. One thing we didn't talk about, but should have definitely, is getting your eyes on them, first of all. And I think it's easy to overlook how crucial that step is, and because it's hard. It's the hardest thing to do. It's a lot easier to dip them in and move along. But I think having your eyes on the animals and noticing things that are outside of the normal patterns is easier said than done. But my biggest takeaway here.
Jim, have you got last comments or an additional topic? Maybe something about our Asian longhorn ticks?
Hey, do you guys want to make any comments? Because that's been another parasite that's kind of been in the news. Is there any kind of we're running kind of long on time here, but either of you have any comments on that? Because that is in the U.S., kind of southern Iowa, Missouri, kind of down in that area. Any kind of last minute comments on would that affect us? Maybe again, kind of related to the upper Midwest.
Yeah, I can throw a quick one out there because I'll start with the diptychs you talked about, Fred. They're primarily for ticks, right? That's why that was in there. And it's amazing if you start looking across some of our older farmsteads where you can find them in Iowa and Minnesota. They're often been filled into the gravel, but the diptychs are there. Historically, they were there. If you look at some old processing facilities, you can find them in the upper Midwest as well. But back to the Asian longhorn tick, that's a new one, Asian in origin. It's new to the United States. It was detected officially in 2017 on the East Coast. It's been moving. I think the latest thing I read, it's been detected in 23 states. It's kind of moved from there. The unique thing about that one from the cattle perspective is that is considered one of the primary transmission vectors for Tularemia, which is going to be cause clinical signs similar to anaplasmosis in cattle. So it's another rule out for cattle that have that poor doing anemic type thing because it is a parasite of blood cells. Recent case was found in southern Iowa over the summer. And in that case, case of Tularemia associated with the Asian longhorn tick on the animal. And one of the interesting things about that Asian longhorn tick that makes it a little bit unique from a life cycle perspective as well, getting back to Dr. Varman's discussion, how important that is, the females of the Asian longhorn tick can actually, they don't require mating. They don't need a male. So you can have a single tick on an animal can actually produce, it produces, 1,000 to 2,000 eggs at a time. And so you can have a single tick actually cause a highly infested animal and a spread of the tick range with that movement, right? You don't have to get at least two. It only takes one in this case, right? So that's one that's been kind of consistently moving from that East Coast, kind of west and south. People will talk about, we're getting warmer climates and things like that. Is that going to allow it to move farther north and things like that? I actually don't know what the temperature barrier would be for that one, but it's a new one that needs to be on our radar in the Midwest because it's moving towards us and will bring with it, unfortunately, a new disease that has no approved treatment in the United States. That's kind of the other big thing with the Tularemia. It's a protozoal disease, and so we do not currently have an approved treatment for that for cattle, right? So prevention becomes a big deal as we think about that. So again, moving cattle, kind of your scenario you said, Fred, is you bring cattle from, in this case, it would be the East Central states. Move those cattle in. You have another concern to think about potentially on how those cattle are managed and how you manage them after you get here to do that. Because again, probably primarily moved through cattle or livestock movement, right? In
Yeah, and
those situations.
as cattle get more expensive, we're probably going to see more southern cattle come north. I worked in the feedlots. They were cheaper cattle than buying western cattle. My only comment
Exactly.
was, and I don't mean to make light of this disease, but we're just darn lucky the human species can't reproduce without males, or I think we'd maybe all be extinct here, at least the males on this call. Man, that scares me a little bit. We're maybe fortunate as a species.
HR will be contacting you directly, Jim.
Well, I mean, that's just a comment. I just think that is a really unique trait of an individual. I think there's a few other species that are able to do that, but that is maybe a little bit scary. I don't know. But I don't have any other comments.
Before Jim switches feet there, we're going to go ahead and close out. We thank Dr. Goldsmith and Dr. Varnum for sharing their expertise and knowledge with us about some of these hot new topics that are going to affect the health, have the potential to affect the health of the livestock we work with every day. Again, thank you very much. We look forward to our next podcast.
Yep, thank you. Bye.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you both.
We'd like to thank our annual sponsors, including our gold sponsor, Iowa Corn Growers Association. Please visit their website at iowacorn.org. We'd also like to thank our silver sponsors, Pioneer, Connor Agri Service, Diamond V, and Central Vet Clinic. I-29 Moo University is an equal opportunity educator. For the full discrimination statement, visit extension.iastate.edu/diversity/ext.